How do you decide like that you want to incorporate a feature?
Everything for us. So we segmented the market. We very much focused on one segment of the market, which is data centers.
When do you think this the right time to hire a salesperson?
Any tips or what to look out for or what to avoid?
You need someone who will come in, not necessarily take the reins, but empower you, watch you, observe you, and they're trying to replicate the process.
What is your experience with dealing with general VCs versus those who are immersed within like construction technology or built environment?
I find the tier one VCs in tech have more of an appetite, I would say. They're willing to make bigger leaps. They're less conservative.
When Dave Mitchell decided to found XYZ Reality in 2017, he had a bold vision to revolutionize construction with the world's most accurate augmented reality headset. But with a background in construction rather than tech, and AR still in its early stages, convincing investors to back that vision was an uphill battle. On this episode of Bricks and Bytes, Dave shares the inside story of XYZ Reality's journey from a bag of wires to a pioneering AR platform. The challenges of building cutting-edge hardware, lessons learned from hundreds of investor pitches, and his unwavering conviction that AR will one day enable anyone to build an extension on their house, no pencil required. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us by heading over to www.bricksbytes.show and signing up to our newsletter. This is an easy and free way which helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, you'll receive all of the key insights from each of the guests we have on, as well as some bonus content about what's going on in the wider world of construction tech. And now, an announcement from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Shift, helping contractors like you leverage BIM to secure a leading position in the race towards construction's digital future. Visit maketheshft.digital for more. This episode is brought to you by Build Vision, transforming construction supply chain by bringing contractors, manufacturers, and stakeholders onto a single software platform. Visit buildvision.io to find out more.
Dave, founder and CEO of XYZ. So your company, XYZ, founded in 2017. You've raised a total of $37 million. Is that right?
Pounds.
Oh, even better. And it's an augmented reality solution that prevents rework and help tracks real-time data on job sites. Is that right?
That's what we do today, yes.
Okay, cool. So, when did you decide that XYZ was needed?
I grew up in the industry. Do you want me to touch on that briefly?
Yes, yeah.
So, father was a builder, learned to walk on a building site. My classic intro, but I love it.
It's important. I think like knowing where people come from.
Yeah.
Because we have all sorts of people. Some people are never in construction. Some people grew up on a job site.
Yeah. So that was fun with your father. You can imagine all that.
Getting your ass kicked.
Yeah, basically. You saw it, right? He's like, whatever about your way, we'll do it my way. That was his motto. But did that on the west of Ireland on small domestic housing. Then I kind of moved into more commercial scene, construction management. Then became an architect for all my sins, practicing in Paris, but actually missed construction. Moved back to major construction here in London. I got to work on some incredible projects here in London, the Shard, Battersea Power Station, many more. And then my last stage of my career before founding XYZ was building data centers around Europe. Mm-hmm. So it was really along that journey. Loads of people ask me, like, what compelled you? Like, I don't know why I got so obsessed with paperless construction. Maybe it was that time I got told to knock down a wall for putting it in the wrong position, right? I don't know. But I just became obsessed with a better way forward and how we could build faster, because I'd been on the site, I'd received the drawings, and then you had to position it in a certain location, right? And then I was on the other side of the fence where I'd produce the drawings. Mm-hmm. And then I'd look at the drawings 2 days later and I was like, what the hell did I draw there? No wonder they're making mistakes outside. So the penny kind of dropped in around 2014, 2015. I was thinking, well, the very first prototype was actually a projector projected on the floor with 2D drawings.
Oh, wow.
But then it was kind of like, how do you localize that?
Yes. It was set in one place, right?
So, yeah. So then Wave Guides or the HoloLens came on the market. And I was like, boom. You know, if we could get this 3D model loaded into a 3D environment and you could see a hologram positioned accurately to its location on site, that would be a potential game changer. So I tested it out. I became obsessed.
That was 2013, you said?
2013, 14 was when I became obsessed with the notion of paperless construction. How do I solve it? And then 2015, I think that's around the time when the HoloLens came to market. And I was like, oh, that's
cool. I need to do that.
Yeah. So I actually tried the HoloLens first. But the accuracy was an issue for us. And there was health and safety concerns. So decided to build our own that was dedicated for the industry. And you have to be a bit crazy to do that.
But I was going to say, going from paperless to then like creating this full-blown site safety AR headset is quite an extreme jump.
Yeah, for sure. But like I trialed it. There was a particular project in Ireland, but I became so convinced, you know, in that approach that I deployed a proof of concept on a project in Ireland whereby it wasn't with holographic technology. It was more like, I converted a model to a basic line drawing and just put it out to all the instruments out on site. And that was back before there was plugins for it and everything, but there was a 5x increase in efficiency on setting out on site. I was like, wow, this could be mega. Then we went one step further and we actually, we built a prototype and we built a bathroom, a small bathroom pod. And it was, my co-founder, a technical co-founder, who had never, you know, built a block wall in his life, hands soft as butter kind of thing.
Technical in a sense of programming, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Versus my brother, who's a builder and an engineer. And he was actually 17 times faster at doing the task. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, okay, that's the power of just being able to position this in the right location. So again, just kind of reinforcing, we got to do this.
Yeah.
So then it got to a stage where I was doing both. I had a full-time job and I was doing a startup at night. And then when I stopped showing up to work and my old boss rang me, he goes, "Dave, where are you?" I'm like, "Sorry, I've got this other thing going on now."
Was it that extreme, that sudden?
It was. It got to a stage where it just started taking off. But luckily, it was in their best interest because my previous employer was preceded the business.
Okay.
Yeah. So that project that was successful on the 5x increase in efficiency was their project.
Oh, so it was already like market fit, right?
And that was like the validation. That was the proof of concept out in the field.
So your line manager hated you, but the company loved you.
Yeah, I still think they love me.
So this holographic technology, you called it holographic?
At the time, but basically what I mean is waveguides.
Yeah.
That's the key enabler, right? Is that you can see that piece of glass that's inside the helmet, through that you see what appears to be a hologram like you see in Star Trek. I think the market's more familiar now with augmented reality.
Yes, yeah. Can you say that you like were pioneering? How do you say it?
Proprietary?
No, when you are starting the leading the industries of in the holographic technologies.
We didn't.
Or you use this existing technology to your
exactly, industry. But it was pretty early days. I mean, when I think back, then like first of all, I mean there was a number of challenges, right? There was like me, this crazy builder, in his mid-20s, bagging down these research labs trying to get this glass, which was a hot commodity at the time, right? Mm-hmm. And saying, can we get your tech to use it in a helmet? They're like, what do you want to do? We want builders building from holograms. You know, I've been in basements down at London Docks there with companies, early proprietary stuff. It was really cool. So that was actually a big challenge for us. We actually got funded, and we're like,
sounds
right.
Surprising. Sounds surprised.
It's been quite a journey. Yeah. It's been a journey for sure. I mean, back then construction wasn't, it was like you'd knock on a VC and you're like, hey, we got a cool company. And they're like, what do you do? And we're like, hardware. And they're like, oof. And they're like, what market? And when we're like construction, they're like, get out.
Yeah, we'd love to get onto that VC part because a large chunk of our audience are actually venture capitalists. So we'll get onto that later on. Okay, XYZ. Where are you right now? So I just believe this is a relatively new model of the headset.
Yes, so we've had a few iterations prior to this. We showed you the museum earlier, right? So the early prototype was like literally like looking through a letterbox. You could barely see any hologram. But the key was that it was positioned accurately. So that was like our first tech milestone that allowed us to get. So like the first, we got the pre-investment from J Coffee Construction, great company. They were the folks who saw the proof of concept out in the field. That allowed us to build an early prototype, which was like wires everywhere, a small bit of early AR technology, waveguides that you could see through, but it was like looking through a letterbox. Mm-hmm. Now imagine like looking through a letterbox trying to see a whole building. It was kind of, mm-hmm. But the main point was it was super accurate. So that got the interest of the venture capitalists. Then we got our first major funding round of £5 million.
Mm-hmm. And the initial VCs were happy because you had that like customer. Was it just a single customer?
The first one with Coffees was pre-revenue. So Coffees was just like they believed in the vision. They saw what the capabilities were, like if we could crack paperless construction. And actually, that's a funny story in itself. When I went into the managing director for J Coffees, and I told him about, you know, AR tech. This is before AR tech was out there. And you could position it out on site accurately. And you could just build it from the hologram. And he goes, you could just then mark the line with a pencil. And I was like, Jim, you wouldn't even need a pencil. And he was like, boom. Yeah, well, where do I sign? Where do I sign?
Panic attack.
You don't need a pencil. That's awesome.
Yeah. So it was J Coffee, and then you said you raised like, was it five million?
5 million was the first institutional investment.
They're based in London, UK?
Correct, yes. Yeah. So that was Amadeus and Hoxton Ventures.
Okay, interesting.
Has like the VC validation changed anything in your thinking that you were able to raise like institutional money?
It's a good boost, right? 5 million in the bank, it certainly gives you confidence that, right, I can build this to the next phase. But really, you're still searching for that product market fit, right? Mm-hmm. You still have to do it. It's a little bit different for hardware, right? You have to build the hardware first and you need money to build the hardware. Whereas a lot of software founders can build it enough to get a proof of concept out there with customers that are paying for it.
Yeah, it's so cheap to build like a software MVP.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably just some AI tool now, you just tell it what you want.
Exactly. So hardware is kind of like, it feels like hardware is like always around behind mm-hmm. software to get to where we need to get to.
Mm-hmm. In terms of like when you were starting the journey, not 11 years ago, what has changed in terms of like what were you thinking about the product at that time, and where are you thinking about the end goal in terms of, for example, Atom product? Like what else that needs to be built within the space for a headset like that?
Well, for me, we still have a long way to go compared to, you know, the imagination versus reality is, you know, even 11 years ago, it's a very hard problem to solve, mm-hmm. you know. doing just augmented reality is tough, but positioning it accurately out on site in a constant dynamic changing environment, it's no, you know, it's a big problem to solve. So the vision remains the same. We want builders building from holograms. We want everyone wearing these headsets on site and everyone to have access to like a mirror world reflection of that site through a desktop portal. So I always kind of imagine like the desktop portal is kind of like, do you ever play Team Hospital or them early strategy games back in the day?
I have not.
But it's literally like what you see on screen is a digitized version of what's happening out on site in real time. So people moving around, resource moving around, elements been built. And these are capturing all that data in real time and everyone's wearing them. So that hasn't changed. The steps, how we're getting there perhaps has changed over time because either we've had to wait for certain technologies to develop more or certain parts of the platform were easier to construct than other parts. That part has changed over time.
Mm. How do you decide like that you want to incorporate a feature? Say, because like you are, one, you're mixing hardware and software. Yeah. So you're trying to balance those two. And then on the other side of things, you've got customers that are like, oh, can you do this? And then you're like, maybe.
Yeah.
How do you decide?
So we were very, I mean, focus is everything for us. So we segmented the market. We very much focused on one segment of the market, which is data centers. We do a bit of pharma, but very complex mission critical projects. And we focused on serving them in particular. So the first part for us was we built a headset that was able to position a static hologram out on site super accurately, but had no cloud connectivity or data plugged in. Once you start plugging in all that data, as you've seen in the demo today, a whole other world opens up.
Yes.
Project controls. So now you're able to serve people who aren't necessarily wearing the headset, but you're extracting the value from one headset and you're distributing it to all project stakeholders. So when that kind of light switch happened, it was like, what set of tools do we build to please who next? And we very much went for the top-down approach. We said we'd, you know, the people are ultimately holding the purse strings, right? The decision makers. And serve them the data we're extracting from the platform to enable their decisions and then kind of work top down and bottom up at the same time.
Because I can see your site management skills coming back into your current role from site team to now tech.
Yeah. And look, we work very closely with our customers as well. So we're always listening to what they want. And with that, we're able to prioritize accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you see the headset being used mostly for blue collar or white collar workers on site?
What do you mean?
Like labor or people who install things or?
So today we're serving both. So we have instances, we're just getting into this, but we'll have a really cool story pretty soon. Maybe we'll give you the heads up first.
You're going to share it now?
It's a project over in America and they're actually setting out directly from holograms in the field. And it's 5 times faster than what the previous method was. Mm-hmm. So the details of all that we can release at a later date, but that's kind of like the bottom up approach I was talking about. And then the top down is like our project controls with all our existing customers. So if you kind of take this and the common denominator is the design is plugged into that headset and positioned accurately out on site, that's useful to everyone. Mm-hmm. Really, because you need that to build the building. What you do with it and how we dice it up into different features really comes down to, you know, who's shouting the loudest in some cases, right?
Yeah.
And who are bigger customers or smaller customers, you kind of have to balance that. That's where kind of product management comes into play. It's a fine art.
Yeah, so it's kind of iterative. Yeah, maybe you do have a strategy, but it can kind of bend a little bit if it needs to, depending on who's shouting loudest.
For sure.
She's paying the most dollar.
Or pound.
Oh yeah, we're in the UK. Sorry. So do you have reservations about how the headset might look on people on site? Because, you know, construction's not very forgiving. Like, you've probably had the stories on site where someone wears something that's not like within the norms of the lads, and it's like,
yeah,
what the is that?
Well, I think it's better than the status quo, first of all. I think it looks cooler, but I mean, we wear a lot of weird stuff out on site. I think, you know, I think it's a pretty helmet, you know what I mean? But I don't think it bothers people too much. I think we're very practical in construction, right? We're like, how does this help me to do my job is the main thing. Or how does this, if it keeps you safe, there's no questions asked, really. You know what I mean? So yeah, I don't see that argument.
No, fine. Love it.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on like a company building as well. So now you are 130, 107?
Yeah. 135, I think is the latest figure. Yeah.
Okay, so can you tell us about the journey from, let's say, three of you or until now? How does the company building looked like in XYZ?
Yeah, for sure. Tough. So starting off with three of us, it was kind of like, Murray, I don't know if he's in today, but I'd love for you to meet him. He's like, he's my technical co-founder. Mm-hmm. And I had a bag of wires and a load of tech when I met with him, and I just basically dumped it on his desk.
So you're a division guy, right?
Yeah, and I was just like, make this work, you know? Mm-hmm. And
how did you meet? Like, what's the...
So it's LinkedIn, just searching around for the right people. So and
I've got a bag of wires, come and meet me.
Yeah, at Pret. That's where we met.
Really?
Yeah. And I rang him on Christmas Eve and he answered. So that was...
Wow.
That was a good signal for me, you know what I mean? Because in the early days, you have to be online. Well, even now, it's 24/7, you know? So he was responsive and he believed in the crazy vision. His father is a builder as well, so he could relate to it when he went home and he spoke with his father. And he said, yeah, let's do it. And Murray's a relentless guy. Like, just, we were at it morning, noon, and night. It is your world. It becomes your world and it consumes you. So I loved Murray's passion straight away. Answering on Christmas Eve, he was like super intrigued. Loved that it was in construction because he was a tech guy and his father was in construction. So it was a good match. Mm-hmm. And we hit it off and we got along, which is very important. And no looking back since.
Yeah, from a few of you, how quickly did it take to go from like, let's say, zero to the first 10 and then maybe like 10 to 50 and any interval you feel significant from there?
I'm trying to think back. So we went from working at home, then we actually won an incubator position in London Business School. And that was a small office, smaller than this. You couldn't even swing a cat in it. It was that small. And there was three of us in it. And while we were there just developing, Murray was developing offsite, but it was a place for us to meet, a hub for us to meet, which is pretty cool. But as we were there, we started recruiting on campus. So Waleed, you've probably seen him in some videos. That's where we met him. So we started recruiting people organically,
I suppose. Cool.
And it was basically like...
Sounds like a hack.
Yeah, the interview process is basically come in, are you willing to work around the clock and are you good at what you do? Yes. Pull out your laptop, let's go.
That's nice. So you're not really looking at that necessarily the technical expertise, it's the attitude.
It's the attitude in the early days for sure. Yeah,
the grind. The grind. Yeah, and on that, you mentioned like in the early days that you were a top salesperson. So in XYZ, so you've been there.
You have to be because, first of all, you might have other salespeople initially. So, but you have to fully understand the product and you have to be able to understand how to navigate these organizations. And then kind of replicate. You want to kind of copy paste that. So you really want to get that sales motion going, right? Mm. And get away from founder-led sales.
When do you think this the right time to hire a salesperson?
Well, I didn't get it right the first time for sure. I think I went through, you know, I've tried it, three different approaches.
Tips or what to look out for or what to avoid?
I think the lesson I learned is probably number one, I let go too early. I was like, all right, you're a professional, take the reins, go for it.
Mm.
Went on their past record. I was like, wow, that's impressive. And it was in construction, you know, construction tech. And I was like, you know, yes, go for it.
Tick the boxes.
They're going to print money, you know. but it's a very different product, right? As you can see, it's different from other products that they were used to selling. Mm. So you just can't take that for granted. So yeah, I learned that over time. And then it was like, okay, you need someone who will come in alongside you, not necessarily take the reins, but empower you, watch you, observe you. And they're trying to replicate the process. And that's Harry, who's our CRO now. He's very good. Like, you know, he kind of let me do my thing. Let me train up some of the reps. And he's knitting the process in the background. And that's worked very well for us, for sure.
So literally like having the salespeople shadow you at the top level.
Out in the field. Yeah. We're out in the field together. They're with me. Gradually I'm easing off and Harry's backfilling. That's working really well.
Yeah, excellent. How do you like on, I think sales is an interesting point. We've got another point here about like the long sales cycle in construction, because it does make it difficult to sort of forecast like perhaps revenue and what's coming in. So yeah, how do you deal with that? And typically like from the point of first contact, say someone says we're interested, like is it like a time? Does it take like a year, 2 years for them to actually adopt your solution?
We're seeing our average is, I think we have 112 days, if you want to get super awesome. Average.
That's like,
we say 3 to 6 months.
From hello to, yes, we will purchase that.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And we kind of look around, the compelling event is project start. So if you can work the whole deal around that, mm-hmm. then at least you have a compelling event. Otherwise, it's just going to go on and on and on, right? So, and our solution is applicable from breaking ground. So works quite nicely.
Yeah. How does your customer like account for ROI? Like what's their measurement of, like should we use it or should we not use it? Like what's their thinking?
So there's two types of customers. There is people who are very ROI focused. There's also others who just understand the problem. And from the rework perspective, we have a load of case studies. Basically, over time, we've built up. In the early days, you were selling dreams. Yeah. You know what I mean? You were selling a thesis. And it's in the founder's conviction. You know, you're there trying to convince them, you're building their trust. You're like, I'll do whatever it takes. You can call me any time of the day. I'm going to make this work no matter what. And then over time, your thesis becomes a reality and you build up these case studies that you can now reference.
Yeah.
So you can reference both the case study, but also a customer with a similar problem to the next customer you talk to. And you just kind of build and build and build on that. But in the early days, it's very much like, you were staring them down. You were like, I will do whatever it takes to make this happen. And here's all the proof I can give you theoretically that it is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And you look for that champion customer and they fall in love with you, hopefully. And you do your first project together. And if the ROI is there, they'll give you more business. If it's not there, bye-bye. And you part hands. Luckily, we've had zero churn since the founding of the business. So we're in a good position.
Nice. Steph kind of reminded me of a podcast episode we done last week where someone mentioned about tech on the shelf, where it's basically where people adopt, like buy software, whatever it is, and just don't use it. So yeah. I'm interested how people implement X, Y, Z and how you sort of, I think the word in the startup world is like stickiness, maybe.
Yeah.
But like, how do you implement and how do you keep people sort of like using the product?
Our approach initially was to provide a managed service. That was like our stimulus pack. It was like, get out there. We're the professionals. We understand how the tech works. We'll just do it for you, and you get the value from that service. Because look, it's unlike anything else that's out there in the market, right? Certainly a couple of years ago, we're seeing more headsets come out now and hopefully more in the future. But when we first went out, it was very new. And there's new and shiny, and there's new and valuable. And we wanted to fall into the new and valuable bucket. And we did that by stimulating the project and supplementing it with a managed service and proving out that model over time. Now we're like, look, this is the ROI. And now we offer you do it yourself as well. So you have the option to either still engage with us in a managed service. We might stimulate the first project for you. But after that, we are trying to educate you to be able to use this tool and take it and run yourself.
Yeah, from scalability point of view, that's much better model.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll find quite a few construction startups follow a similar path where it's like custom software or just like hand holding in the early stages, and then taking a step back, which, as Martin says, results in the scale.
If I can jump in quickly, like, what's the average time for people to be able to operate the headset and the software on sites and within their offices? How much time does it take them to?
So some people get it in an hour, but we kind of provision for 3 weeks.
Okay, that's quick.
It's pretty, I mean, you've worn the headset there. It's pretty intuitive. Mm. Like, you operate in it. We understand the 3D environment, so it's actually easier to interpret than.
So I think the headset part is very simple.
Yeah.
The question is about the platform and software. I don't know, because I've not used it. Yeah, but headset is super simple.
Yes.
So do people have most queries that come back to you either from using the headset point of view or from using the platform?
It's the value is delivered through the platform for sure. Mm-hmm. We extract the value from the field with the headset, and then we surface that insight in the platform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. On that point, hardware and software is an interesting interface. So we get the argument with robots as a sort of example where people building robots should actually focus more on the software side of it, because there's certain intricacies of detailing. One example we heard the other day was mortar joints, and it has to be programmed through software and not just focusing on the hardware itself. So how do you balance the kind of I guess the team dynamic and also the R&D of the product between that physically, which is there, and also the guys building the technology behind it?
It's kind of supply and demand, really, isn't it? It's like, oh, we need more people in this area. And we'll ask a number of questions, and they're prove it. And then we're like, okay, you need more people in this area. And it kind of grows organically like that. So, we started off with a small core hardware team. And then you build hardware, then you need firmware, then you need an application to run on the headset. Then you need a cloud team to be able to build it in the cloud. It kind of grows organically from that. But then you still need to keep doing R&D in the background for the next generation of the headset and localization. So we split the hardware into generations, which are 18 to 24 month cycles. And then software is incremental releases on a quarterly basis right now.
So you said 18 months of the cycle for what to produce the...
To produce each generation, yeah.
Okay.
18 to 24 months, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Can you tell a little bit more? I don't know if it's a secret sauce or not, but how do you come to this number of 18 months or so?
Well, I come to that number because I want to do it faster, but the professionals keep telling me they can't. I'd love it every year, you know what I mean? But there's only, their analogy as well is it takes only so many midwives to deliver a baby in hardware, whereas software you can kind of do parallel, you can stack software, right? You throw 100 people in software. Hardware is a little bit more, it's kind of like building a building, actually. It's a bit more linear in how you build the hardware. And then you get it to an engineering prototype, and then you have to make it manufacturable. You know, there's a process there you have to follow.
Yeah, testing, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Testing, verification. So you have the initial R&D part where you crack the magic. I'd love to show you it on camera, but, you know, the R&D version of this is a beast. It's a monster. And then you have to kind of miniaturize that down into a wearable format, you know, try and get it to 1 or 2 kgs where you can wear it and test it. Then you have to get it. A certification is an absolute nightmare. We have all the health and safety standards globally we have to meet for the visor and for the hard hat. And then you have all your certification for all the electronics globally to meet. Like, it's no mean feat, you know. It's a difficult endeavor for sure, but we totally believe in the benefits it's going to bring to humanity and the construction industry, and that's why we're gunning for it.
Sounds very complicated. How do you manage it all?
Just hire great people. I think it's not always about who went to the best colleges, right? It's really about culture and about just kind of breeding this hub of innovation and about people who believe in the impossible and will never give up. And you have to wear that on your sleeve. You know, I could break into tears now just thinking about it, but like, incredible people, that's, you know, just, and finding them people. I'd rather take 6 months to find the right fit. That's another lesson learned. You know, wait to 6 months to find the right fit is important too, you know.
It's very easy. It's like, I need someone.
Yeah.
Like, I need them now.
Yeah.
And that obviously results in mistakes, as it sounds like you've learned. So.
I've learned that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and as a young founder, you're like, "Oh, I just need it.
Get going."
Yeah, we'll work around it. But
we need the headset in 6 months, not 18.
Dave, just want to touch on the current limitations of augmented reality and like concept that you have with the headset. What is the main pain point right now from the development point of view, perhaps, or to make the device and software better?
So right now we have the most accurate headset on the planet, but we're limited on range, and we want to increase that range. So
by range, you mean
in the range of like in a 10 by 10 zone or 20 meter by 20 meter zone, we want to get that to site wide anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of think about that, being able to position a point in space anywhere in the world, millimeter accuracy, that's a tough challenge. And we've hired the best in the industry to do that. And it's looking really, really exciting. But again, productionizing that and getting that up and running, that's our challenge right now, right? So, but the next gen is very much, this generation is like, you need a certain level of construction experience to understand and operate it. The next level, the next generation, I want my mother to be able to go out and build an extension on her house. You know what I mean? I want it to be that easy to just plug and play, walk out and go. No training, to your point earlier, right? You want everyone totally, fully immersive, guided experience from when you put it on. It's so intuitive. Everything loads up for you. Everything localizes for you. Right now, there's training involved in that process. But removing them barriers over time is, and ruggedizing it so you don't, you know, I worked on site for years. I finish, you know, when I was on the tools, I'd finish at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, whatever it is. I'd go into the drying room and I'd fling my hard hat across the drying room and run home. We want to be able to ruggedize this tech as well so that you can. Maybe not throw it across to
Detroit. Like, can we test it?
Not yet. But right now it's very much an engineering instrument, right? You have to handle it with care. you can't just throw it in the back of the van, but someday we,
well, you can, but it's the last time you're using
it. Do they come with insurance?
You mentioned extensions, kind of probably a little bit jokingly, but like, are you thinking about expanding type of projects that the headset would be useful on?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what, maybe you can also touch on what currently type of projects are you, do you get involved in?
Yeah, I mean, look, we get inquiries for all sorts of projects, but again, it's down to focus. And we focused our sales team as well on one particular vertical. So we do get inquiries from the commercial space for residential towers, etc. But we just say, you know, thanks very much. Come back to us at a later point. Mm-hmm. We're very much focused on very dense, complex projects where timelines are tight, things don't scale too well in construction. We kind of know that, right? So we're focused on them projects. From there, we will expand on into neighboring verticals. But for the next year, most definitely, we're just going to remain in mission critical. But ultimately, we want to get to the domestic market and beyond, right? Eventually, someday, we can pop into B&Q and perhaps buy one of these and hang up a shelf, you know. But for now, that's not the case.
So perhaps XYZ can be B2C product at some point, not B2C.
At some point, yeah. And I'm very open about this. I want this to be a public company that's backed by the industry. You know, the industry believes in this product. They'll back it. And we want this to be available for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also AI recently has been boosting the demand for data centers, right? So you guys are
for sure
in a very good position to great timing, test as much as you kind of can, yeah?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And the hand that feeds us is healthy is always a good thing too.
Mm. You mentioned about having them on B&Q. I can just see the writing on the wall in your office that says, XYZ Reality Helmet in B&Q. Does that get you up in the morning?
You probably want to see it in Tesco's.
In Tesco, yeah. So we'll see. We'll see.
You'll go at Amazon. Next level down. How do you see, please don't punch me in the face, Apple Vision Pro disrupting AR and potentially construction?
I think it's only a good thing. We want to see more AR devices in the space, to be honest, because, you know, it's a big world, you know. We'd love to scale these helmets to have headsets on everyone in the world, but maybe someday we'll release a reference design that all the major tool manufacturers, we're like, we've done all the R&D, we know how to do it, here's a reference design, you go build it, and there might be various, maybe there's a DeWalt version or a Hilti version out there, but they all plug into our platform. So look, I think I'm here to stimulate and improve the industry. I'm not selfish. I don't want to blanket it off for anyone else. I think, you know, dig in and let's move this industry forward. We have enough problems. Mm-hmm. Why get greedy?
Nice.
But back to the Apple Vision Pro, I think it's a good thing for us because, whenever Apple brings something to market, it kind of is kind of recognized as here to stay. That's kind of people's attitude, right? Up until anything's released before Apple, it's kind of like, is it a flash in the pan? Is it just a fad? But generally, I think people accept things are here to stay when Apple release a device. Is their device currently suited for construction sites? Well, no. It doesn't meet the health and safety requirements, but it's one step further in the right direction. Yeah.
The range limitation you mentioned earlier, is it like caused by LiDAR scanners or that's something completely different?
So for accurately positioning, we use laser-based positioning. So it's a limitation on the lasers, mm-hmm. But the next generation has overcome that problem. And that's going to be a game changer. But that's all I'll say for now.
Okay.
Sounds good. Compared to, let's say, 360 camera reality capture. How does XYZ sort of compare in terms of like the quality of the product and also how, yeah, like the insights it gives and maybe how people use it?
So, I mean, the main differentiator is the cadence, like, so it's real time capture. So as soon as it's captured outside, it's reflected in the platform. And it's intelligent data. Everything's already plugged in. So we plug the schedule into the model. The model's overlaid out on site. And in one instance, you can check it's verified it's in the right location. Has it been installed at the right time? When it was started, when it was finished, and how many people it took to install it. So the accuracy that all that data is key, not only for telling you where you are in time, but also for forecasting the future as well. So we're all about accuracy. That's like a core value for us. So accurately positioning the model, accurately capturing the data from the field is two key aspects for us. And leveraging that accurate data will help us inform the future for analytics. So scenario analysis. And also, you know, who performed best in what region, et cetera, et cetera.
I like that one. You should, Joe was showing us earlier, you can literally, with XYZ, you can track like one site is moving at like 10 whatever meters per day, where another site is moving at 5 or 6 meters per day. And then
exactly.
What the hell are you doing over there?
Yeah. Whereas the other solutions are more like snapshots in time. And they don't relate back to any data.
But the advantage is with, I guess, XYZ, you need a BIM model to be on site, whereas with the other reality capture, it's more just like, because it's focused more on 2D.
Yeah. I mean, look, we do provide, you get the 3D images, 360 image as well. I don't know if Joshua, part of it, but it's all about relating that data and linking all that data back to the schedule of the model and everything else.
And that's where the key value is. This is being done automatically, is it? Or is it, does it need like manual labor, someone to...
There's a human in the loop at the minute, and that human in the loop is wearing the headset, luckily.
Yeah, it's only actually, right?
Exactly. So they're out on site literally doing a spot the difference analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty easy for them to recognize that, and that's training things that will come in future that will automate that process.
Very odd thought I had when I put it on my head was, why is it not robot doing this straight away? If robot has a headset and can just walk around and point out whatever.
Maybe someday robots will do it. So look, this is kind of the future.
It was first thing in my head, once I had it.
The future state I always talk about is the builder is going out to build a wall, for instance. And on that way out to build that wall, the headset is capturing all this in real time, passively. He doesn't even know what's happening. All he sees is the wayfinder out to where he's building and setting out that wall. And so it shows him where to get to, how to get to the wall or that task. He sets up, he knows how many blocks he needs for the wall, how much mortar he needs for the wall. He can even order it through the headset. He builds the wall. But the headset is capturing all that data constantly in real time, feeding it back. We could integrate drones and everything else into it at some stage, but that automation is just not there yet in computer vision.
Yeah, what I just was saying actually was that I felt like I was a robot actually, because it feels like you're in an augmented reality.
But like to the point in that demo, right, you're seeing a lot of holograms. But I think the future state is, you mightn't be looking at the hologram. You're just clicking on an object now, and the metadata related to that object is there.
I mean, without the stick, or
just you mightn't. So if everything's positioned accurately out on site, you don't need to see a hologram all the time. You know, you can just walk around, and when you want to query an object, you click on the object, and the data is there. Right, but there's no actual physical hologram.
Oh, got you. So right now there's no substance behind the element, right?
Correct. Okay. But it'll get to a stage where when we plug in all the data points and you want to, say you're walking along, you see that door, you don't need to see the hologram of the door. You just want to click on the door and the object data about that door is there.
That's interesting. So what about, because this sounds like digital twin kind of idea, right? So
correct.
You've got building which is completed and you want to replace this duct because of some reasons.
Yes.
X, Y, Z reason.
Yes.
And And you're just looking at this and it gives you a manufacture and like color.
Exactly. But that could happen at any point. That could happen mid-build as well, mm-hmm. right? You might want to see what quality processes have been conducted up to this point, or commissioning, on the commissioning side, have all these checklists been ticked off, right? So there's many instances where that can come into play, but it's just like you can switch it on and off when you need it. But it's a health and safety piece of equipment that everyone's wearing. That keeps you safe. So it's there when you need it. That's when ultimately everyone's building from holograms. And we know this is really taking root on these projects.
One more question on this, and I think we'll go into some VC stuff. Doug, on the future of XYZ, you're obviously collecting a shed load of data. Mm-hmm. And quite often the data is the value of the company itself. So mm-hmm. Can you reveal any future plans or do you have a plan for that, or is it just kind of like we'll aggregate everything now and then see what can be done?
So we capture everything, and when we do enter with our customers, we're like, you have two options. We can collect all your data and give you analytics about all your projects, but you won't know how you compare to anyone else. So you can opt in or out for that. And some people are happy with that. And some people want to know how they're competing against everyone else. That's a choice for our customer. Mm-hmm. I think it works.
So almost like a health, maybe a competition. I don't know. Is that like a red pill, blue pill kind of thing?
It's good for some industries, but there's some parts of certain sectors that you cannot share information.
You know? Okay.
Yeah. So you let data centers, for instance, you know, you don't want to be sharing that data about competition. But in other sectors, it's not as much of a problem. You know, they want to be as good as everyone else or better. Mm-hmm. Where the data itself is less sensitive. That's what I mean.
Yeah. So is the plan to go from an AR to like a digital twin platform, maybe?
I always call it like the construction operating system.
That's a good name. Yeah.
And that's the way I think of it. Mm. And it's kind of merging the digital and the real. That's the future of this industry. It's going to be merging. Like eventually we're going to have robots. You want to control them robots or be able to interact with them. Like if you just see a robot, you don't know where they're going or where they're moving, but at least if you're wearing the headset and you see the robot, you can see where that robot's moving and where it's allowed to operate in, or exclusion zones or everything. You know, it all kind of plays into the idea of cobots, I suppose, in the future. But I'm rooting for the humans right now. So that's what I'm sticking to.
Still have a few more decades to it, to those, yeah?
At least.
So we are capturing a data, it's a case study. We are capturing the data of a project and turns out that we are late on the project, mm-hmm. 20-30%, right? Mm-hmm. And the site is data center and the company builds 5 data centers at the same time, different locations. Are these 4 other site managers or site teams, can they take some learnings from this data center, which is having a delay?
So
can you facilitate this learning somehow as well?
100%. Today it's manual. But we have some cool stuff. You've probably seen some of the previews today, but it's public knowledge. That is ultimately our goal, right? So all the lessons learned from prior projects, both in terms of performance or maybe a different sequence, unlocked a faster build, you get that insight when you're planning your next project. Or you could propagate it over to a project that's been built that's maybe 6 months behind that project. That's what's beautiful about data centers. There's a lot of cookie cutter projects and it's copy and paste, and they need to build them so quickly And they're trying to do everything they can right now to meet that demand, that if we can optimize that through real-time accurate data, you know, if it's shit data in, it's shit data out. So we want to make sure the data going in is as accurate and clean as possible.
Makes sense. I think the key issue with construction is we do these projects and then everything is forgotten about. And then it's like the next one and the same mistakes happen again and again. Major issue. Okay, so on the VC stuff, Martin, I don't want to hijack your question, but
yeah, so
he asked everyone this question, so don't feel victimized by this.
Is XYZ profitable right now? Or if not, then is it like, what's the path to profitability?
So we're not profitable right now. We're gunning for that towards the end of the year. It's not a mandate. It's not like, you know, we can continue. We can decide, should we just keep growing aggressively? But I want to get to that. I think it's like a nice check. Mm-hmm. Like we're break even, we're profitable.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. So like, what's the, I'm just curious, like what's the alternative? So if we, as a startup founder, you're looking at, okay, so we can be profitable by the end of this year. If not, then we will go into developing like the next generation of the headset. Like yeah. what's the word?
The balance.
Yes, what's the balance?
So it's always a balance. You know, it's also about the market, the fundraising market as well, right? Mm. So you have to be mindful of that. So every step of the way, you're kind of recalibrating. I think it's most sensible right now for any startup to not take future funding for granted. I think you have to operate on the assumption, I certainly am, that there is no more funding out there. Because the market is, it's nearly 2 years now, the market's been down. So we're gunning for break even. I think it's the safest approach for to keep the business alive indefinitely. Otherwise, I think you could be in danger of running off a cliff. And we don't want that. We genuinely want to be here to, we want to be around to change the world. In
yeah,
10
we
years.
Want you here. Good business acumen, I think is the word. I was enjoying the story on the VC at the start of the podcast where you was mentioning that you went to numerous offices and it was just like,
oh yeah,
out of here.
I think I've met like over 1,000 VCs.
Really?
I'd say so. Yeah. And I suppose you get to
learn. Is there any like story that sticks with you about like one maybe falling asleep during your pitch or something?
It's more a risk profile. That was before the PlanGrid acquisition. There was, you know, this is like back, it's not that long ago, right? But 2017 was not hot for construction tech, really. There's a few players and they're still around, thank God, you know, but it was quite new. Construction tech was quite new. You had like Autodesk, Procore. Procore was probably the most successful one.
Getting traction at the time, right?
Yeah. Mm. And then PlanGrid happened after we were going, and that kind of got the VC market interested. I think that was the stimulus that got, they went, oh, there's money to be made in construction tech. I think that's what kind of changed it. But when we first went out, hardware is, it's all about software. Software is sexy. SaaS is sexy for VCs. Hardware is not so
expensive.
Sexy. Yeah. So when we went out, like I said, just spoke with so many. And we used to go in and they'd be like, okay, so what are you doing? And we're like, augmented reality. Like, ooh, hardware. You know what I mean? In what market? Construction. They're like, they might as well have said, get the fuck.
At that point. You know? And you had to go through the pain of like the next like 55 minutes or whatever it is of talking them through.
Just a rejection. It was just like, I mean, we got thick skin of that alone, right?
I can imagine.
But eventually we wound up whittled down and find some, I think the biggest lesson I learned there is, you know, just no more than your customers. You need to bring your investors on a journey. There's like the dating beforehand as well, right? There's like, you need to kind of build trust in them, especially for a product like this, right? when you're pre-revenue as well, it's very difficult. So you kind of build that trust in them. And this investor, Herman Hauser, he's like the Amadeus Capital, where our first investor, he was visiting us. Like, he did Acorn Computers. He was involved with making the chip for ARM, and that's in all our phones today. Like, so he was he's a seasoned hardware investor, but he was visiting us for like 2 years. And he'd come in and be like, good job, David. Yeah, great progress. And we're like, term sheet, you know.
Yeah. Was it just before he leaves? I got someone to ask you. Actually, no, I'll see you later.
So it got to the stage, like, this is 2 years of building a relationship, that he goes, good job, David, walked out. And I was like, so I ran out the door after
him.
And I was like, we're going to fucking do this. We're going to change the world. And then he goes, okay, let's do this.
Really?
Yeah, that's kind of like how we got going with Amadeus. And then Hoxton was very similar as well. They knew on the spot, they were like, we want to do this. But that was after hunting for quite some time.
Yeah.
And then it's more metric driven. It's like, get to your first million ARR, you can go back out to market then and look for the next round, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So that was seed round, yeah?
So that was seed round, yeah.
Yeah. And you're now Series A.
Series A, yes.
Yeah. Very nice. Working with VCs, that was a very entertaining story. Have you got any, like, positive, let's go with positive and then we can go with like not so positive. I don't want to use the word negative, but any kind of insight to that?
I mean, just look, there's...
Or learnings from these negatives?
They're all human at the end of the day. So you need to get along with that person. For instance, that's how you know who you're going to choose. If you don't get along with them, break up, like, whatever the opportunity is, because there's going to be good times and bad times. And if you don't get along, it's not going to work, you know? So I think what's good, a good VC will understand the temperature of the market and what you have to do. They're experts in their field, right? So they will help you shape what your company profile and metrics should look like to get to the next stage. And it's my job to ensure I hit their metrics and, you know, sell and execute, et cetera. So you're looking for a good partnership, as well as, you know, upfront, you need to be upfront about what I don't want to flip this business next week. I want to go IPO. Be very forward about that, like what you want for the business, and see if that matches up. So then you know if you have patient capital or not, because not everyone's patient. So there's good and bad with everyone, but I think it comes down to the person themselves and who you're dealing with.
What is your experience with dealings with general VCs versus those who are immersed within like construction technology or built environment?
I don't want to shoot myself in the foot for future raises here, but generally I find the Tier 1 VCs in tech have more of an appetite for risk, I would say. They're willing to make bigger leaps. They're less conservative.
Mm.
So you mean those within construction tech?
No.
The generalists, okay.
Generalists, yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my experience. I mean, we're quite out there in terms of disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the people, it's kind of like back to, you want people who want to back visions and who want to change the world, not small incremental changes or sustain. It's just like incremental innovation. You want the people I want to talk to are the people who want to change the world at scale.
Mm-hmm.
And with that becomes the biggest ROI for the VC. But they're the kind of people I want to be talking to.
Did you pick like a venture capitalist that had experience? You mentioned, was it Herman?
Herman, yeah.
And what about, so that was the hardware side. What about specifically in construction and reality capture?
They weren't really around back then, to be honest. There wasn't that many construction-focused VC arms around back then. And then there are some newer ones, but they're still they're still young themselves. They still have to prove themselves right? So I don't have much interaction with them, to be honest. And I've no comments on it. I haven't looked at their portfolios, but they're still proving themselves out. Whereas I'm trying to target the tier one seasoned investors.
Yeah. Prospective sort of investors, do you keep the profile of these people, and like, are you regularly in touch, or is it more just like you kind of decide like in the next year we want to raise and then we'll start initiating the contact, or is it like an ongoing relationship?
Yeah, it's an ongoing relationship. You try and meet up with them. It depends on, you know, if you're 2 years out, you wouldn't be ringing them every day, right? But you'd check base with them every couple of months to say, hello, here's our progress. So when you are ready, they already have some history of how you performed. You know, you said you'd do this and you've done this. Especially as you get more and more mature, you want to, whatever you say you're going to do needs to come to fruition. And that gives them confidence in the later rounds.
Mm-hmm. Do you see many startups within the hardware space, within construction tech?
In general, hardware is, there's not a lot of hardware out there. I think there's going to be more and more hardware now, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
I think
we kind of like saturating the software.
Exactly.
Business.
I mean, when you think about it, there's a lot of no-code stuff coming. Code will write itself. I don't want to, you know, go too far out there, but, you know, hardware will become, I think my thesis is hardware will become more and more important again.
Yeah. Once we change everything software related, then we need to go into real life, right? And
yeah,
start changing the real.
Start making the hardware for it to run on.
Yes. So would you have any advice as someone who raised funds within the hardware startup?
Mm-hmm.
Any advice to peers, someone who is trying to get some venture money for their startups within the hardware space?
Today. What stage are they at?
They just...
let's make up a company profile.
Let's make up a company profile. Okay.
But it's got to be seed, I suppose.
Is it seed, pre-revenue?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Because that's very challenging, right? You don't have money. And it costs a lot to build anything, really.
Yeah, because someone... I was also speaking to someone last week and they were like... don't build a startup, go and work at a company. Most businesses aren't VC backable. That was their blunt. He was a VC as well. That was his blunt sort of view on the world.
I think being blunt about hardware is super hard. And maybe, I don't know where we'd be without Jay Coffey, our first pre-seed investor who gave it, because you need someone who understands your vision intricately to make that bet, because, you know, when I think back, like, and I said, it's down to pure conviction. Like, you know, if I went out with just a deck, a pitch deck, saying I wanted to create the world's most accurate engineering grade augmented reality headset, and my background is in construction,
yeah,
it's a tough bet to make, you know.
It's not very compelling, I must admit.
It's, whereas when I, by the time I went to investors, institutional investors, we had a prototype to say that we could do it, you know. So you need someone, angels, you need an angel who believes in your vision. Perhaps it's a hardware product that's not as hard to build. If it's an easier product to build, happy days. But that's as advanced as it gets. That's hard to build. So we had a proof point when we went into them. We were like, it can be done. Mm-hmm. Give us 5 million quid.
Please.
On that, I think we should think about wrapping up soon, but I wanted to just kind of like pivot the conversation a little bit about how you see content, because XYZ is like a content heavy business. So you guys, as of when I was walking in here earlier, you were doing some filming. Yeah. How Like, why? Why do so much?
Because I think we're a visionary company and we have to paint the vision of the future for people as well. I was very passionate early doors to do video for XYZ, not just blogs, because we needed to paint that story of what it's like to experience and use this equipment in the field. So I think it's all down to communication, right? It's like, this is what we're about. This is how we're delivering value. And this is why you should look at us.
Has it had any, do you think it's had an impact on maybe revenue? Like, does it help with sales, or do you think it's more with
image
or what?
Well, think about it. Like, if I went back in 2018 to say to you that I can solve all your problems with engineering grade augmented reality, you'd be like, what the hell are you talking about, David? You know, we kind of lead with the value that we're delivering, and then the video and the content and everything else behind that show how we're doing it or bring it to life. So I think it's incredible. It's valuable for what we're doing, for sure.
It works.
Mm-hmm. All right, so
last one.
For me would be on the charging models within the hardware, maybe software. You can say something about this as well. How do you see charging models within construction tech? Is it, we don't need to know any details on XYZ Atom, mm-hmm. for example, but are we looking at, what's the current model? A charge per headset or per like construction value of the project? Mm-hmm. And how do you see that?
So right now we're on a per headset basis. And then the platform, anyone that has a headset on their project, we charge on a per headset basis, and everyone has access to the platform. We don't charge for that access when they have the headsets. That might change in future if we kind of go platform only, et cetera, but that's how we do it right now. So it's a subscription model.
Mm-hmm. Just, how did you get to that?
How did I get to the subscription model?
Yeah, like you must have thought about a few things.
Thought about like tool hiring businesses, how that operates. I worked for a few subcontractors and it works well within them projects, because projects are temporary. They're a temporary company, so a subscription model works for that.
So after the project, they can give you the headset back? Or
they can give it back, or they can move it on to another project. Typically, when we're talking with customers, I think all of our customers, bar one now, is an enterprise deal. So there's always another project to roll onto or another project coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. So we'll move them on.
Okay. And for Atom, for example, to do this job and be help really with like efficiency and is there like a number of headsets that will be required? 1, 5?
Again, down to focus. So for data centers, we kind of go for every... Well, in general, if I really ballpark it, it's like one headset for every 10 megawatts. But we wouldn't just give that to you blanket statement. We would try and optimize that. We'd take your schedule. Depends how intense the schedule is and how big the building is. But if you wanted to really ballpark it, that's kind of how you have to think about it.
I feel like we needed a closing question. Any ideas?
Closing question.
If you weren't building XYZ, what would you be doing?
I'd still be in construction for sure, yeah.
Throwing your hard hat across the room.
I'd be trying to innovate for something, I think. And even in my last job, I was kind of like an intrapreneur before I became an entrepreneur. So always trying to move the needle, so...
Yeah, that was your life mission.
Yeah. It is too.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you want to go for pints?
Pints? Well, right now?
Let's do it.
Have you got a tap in the office?
No.
It can be arranged. Cool. All right. I think we're done. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, cheers, guys. Cheers. Thanks very much.